From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 23rd day of April 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in this half hour, we'll talk with Bruce Bostard, the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In the second half hour of our program today, on many of these stations at WILLAG.org2, we'll talk with the president of the National Corn Growers Association and hear from Vince Davis, Extension Soybean Specialist at the University of Illinois. And it all happens right here during this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat at $4.93 and a quarter, settlement price down 5 and a quarter today. July at 5.05 and a half, down 5 and a half cents. And September wheat at 5.21 and three quarters, down 5 and a half. July in Kansas City at 5.16 and a half, 4 and a half cents lower on a Friday afternoon. May corn futures 3.53, down 9 and a quarter. July at 3.61, 10 and a half cents lower. September at 3.69 and a half, down 10 and one quarter. And December futures at 3.78 and a quarter, 9 and a half cents lower. March futures at 3.90 and a half, down 9 cents. May soybean futures $10 even, down 4 and a quarter on a Friday. July at 10.10, down 5 cents. August at 10.07, 4 and three quarters lower. September at 9.90 and a quarter, down 6 and a quarter. November bean 6 cents lower at $9.79. May bean meal 292.30, down 3.30. May bean oil at 39.35, up 26. April live cattle futures 99.22 and a half, down 52 and a half cents. May futures there at 112.57 and a half, down 20. And the April live cattle, 99.22 and a half, 52 and a half lower. June at 94.82 and a half, down 77 and a half. April lean hog futures, rather May, at 87.40, 97 and a half cents lower. June at 85.17 and a half, down $1.77 and a half cents. Let me catch the feeder cattle, 112.20, up 7 and a half in April's. The May at 112.57 and a half. Down 20. You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from Urbana-Champaign. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures at $85.09 a barrel, $1.39 higher. May ethanol at $1.58.5, down 3 tenths. Natural gas at $4.26.7, 13 9 tenths higher. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.24.9 a gallon, up 3 4 tenths of a cent. And the gold futures at $1,153.10, a settlement price there at $10.80 higher an ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up just about 44 points at 11,178. And the U.S. dollar down 0.2 at 81.35. The CRB index, or Commodity Research Bureau index, at 279.05 is 1.93 higher. And the Goldman Sachs at 548.62 is up 5.97 on this Friday afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like, as put together by our own staff of weather people here. They say the weekend will see very active weather across the area. Locally heavy rainfall. The forecast has shifted the heaviest rains south of the Ohio River, but some locations in northern and central Illinois are in line for rainfall in excess of 2 inches, as thunderstorms should develop along fronts that move through the area. Temperatures will warm briefly on Saturday before a cold front brings several days of cooler conditions to the region. Drying rates, of course, will be slowed. Flooding will return to some river basins and low-lying fields, mainly in the western part of Illinois. The impact not expected to be widespread, but it may cause some prolonged interruptions for planting in some fields because of the slower drying rates and some follow-up rainfall that should come next week. More on the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with Steve Hilberg. He's a climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. On the line with us to take a look at the agricultural futures markets, Mike Zuzalo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hey, Todd. Good afternoon. Congratulations on the hour-long show. I've been listening all week. It sounds great.
Oh, thank you very much. I know that some of our listeners can hear it. Some would have to get it off Will Ag. I've actually been having quite a bit of fun doing the program. We'll see how it goes. It's a lot of work, but hey, you know, good things come from lots of work, and one of those good things, I suppose, here's a nice transition, is good marketing, right? You have to do a lot of work to do good marketing.
Well, yeah, that, or you're naturally born or blessed with luck, I guess. I don't know. I'm not lucky, so I have to do a lot of work.
Well, what kind of work have you been doing this week?
Well, I didn't think... today's trade certainly, I think, told us a few things, but I thought Monday's trade was probably more important to the producer and to the hedger, because I didn't feel like Monday's break down in most of the markets were all Goldman Sachs related. I felt like that maybe China's property market, the government wanting to slow down the property market and the real estate market over there, was a pretty good and one of three or four indications the last month or month and a half that China is in the camp of having a bubble, and in terms of asset market bubble and real estate bubble. And so I kind of felt like this week, when we reversed and went higher all week long, that the Chicago trade was really looking at it from a standpoint that we've got Chinese weather certainly on the radar screen, we've got Chinese demand certainly on the radar screen, a lack of Argentine bean selling. You spoke about that, I think, this week earlier. I think all those things are very, very important, but I think that when I came right down to it at the end of this week, and I think corn helped solidify this, is that, yes, there is upside potential, but in the beans especially, I think we're probably at a level we got to feed the bull at this stage. At $10 beans, we could go a little bit higher if we don't break some trend lines next week and if we have wheat and corn on our side, but I think maybe we're transitioning away from beans being the leader to the upside to either the corn or the wheat going to have to pull most of the weight here.
Well, given that the weekly changes show beans were up 14 and 13 cents in the Mays and the Novembers. May, of course, settled at 10 bucks. Nice round figure. November at 9.79. You say feed the bull. You want to make sales on new crop beans then?
Yeah, you know, it goes back to what we talked about on Commodity Week, that if the market rallies, I certainly do want to hedge, and I've increased hedges from the 50% level to the 70% level, but I want, like we talked about on Commodity Week, I also want to be very respectful of the bean rally potential. And if there is a continued drought in the Chinese northern plain and Manchurian areas, those are certainly areas that can stimulate more buying by China. And so I think a combination of buying puts and cash sales is the right thing to do, just from a standpoint of diversifying and spreading out your risk in case there is another big leg to the upside, because of some new type of fundamental that does indeed feed the bull. But you bring up a huge point about the net gains for the week. I think that's what kind of solidified, like I'm talking about, kind of solidified the idea that the corn has underperformed a long time. And I think now we're at a point where the corn has underperformed enough that the demand is actually bottoming. And with the beans, the demand is probably getting up towards the top end of the range. And interesting to note, when you look at the beans and where they're at in the meal and where they're at, they're back to levels we haven't seen since the January report turned the market bearish. But when you look at July wheat, we're still 55 cents from that January 12th, January 13th time frame. When you look at Dease corn, we're still 40 cents away from that mid-January price area. So we've got a lot of premium in the beans, and I think the trade's done a really good job of anticipating increasing demand in China. I guess what I'm getting at, trying to look around the corner, I think that demand's going to be hard to come by if they're indeed in a kind of a bubble in their asset markets.
That would not fare well for the United States in the export market, that's for sure.
Well, and that's where it goes back to the currencies. You know, that's another big ripe grape, so to speak, a ripe and important point. We've had the currencies on our side to promote the you know, usually the real and the beans will move in unison with one another, And with the Argentine peso dropping, that's holding back the farmers selling down there, and their inflation is as well. And so you've had some big issues fundamentally that have kept the South American crop off the table. And your point's very well taken, because I heard the middle of this week from a trade contact that one of the big reasons why the corn and the beans both jumped middle of the week was because some commercials in the export market were caught short. They thought they'd have South American product by now. They hadn't gotten it, and it was because of the tight farmer holding. And I think there again, the producers down there are probably going to be a lot more willing to open up their coffers if these currencies start to reverse themselves.
Well, can they really hold for very long? I mean, here in the United States, we have plenty of way to store the crop.
Right.
Is that the case? Does anybody have a handle on what they can do in Argentina and or Brazil? In Brazil, they've had to truck it an awful long way out, and that's simply what they did because it took so long. How about the Argentinians? Can they put it in storage for very long? I suppose the export at the export areas, they might be able to store, but I wouldn't think they could store that much for very long.
No, I think both, and I'm certainly not as adept at it as probably I should be, but I think both those countries don't have the capacity we do to store on farm, nor do they have the way of purchasing inputs to be able to do that. And in the case of Brazil, especially with their second crop and needing to go ahead and plant another crop essentially right behind their first crop, I think their inputs and their costs are going to get after them to where they have to let go some of their first crop soybeans and get some of their money in hand so that they can go ahead and get their next crop planted and sowed.
If that assumption is right, then you're using it in part to say eventually these beans will come to roost and they'll head overseas, right?
Yeah, I think that's the big thing. And it's like I was talking today this morning, when you have a something in Argentina like price inflation, not only are you causing the supply side to hoard because the producer's not getting what he feels like he deserves and he's mad that he's not getting what he feels like he deserves, but you also have the demand side reducing its demand because the prices are naturally a lot higher than they want to pay. And I think China is no different than a lot of other countries in that when prices get to a certain price level, they will rely upon their domestic supplies or figure out another way to not have to buy as much. Obviously, the drought continuing would not put them in a good position to be able to have control, and they would have to be like every other country and have to secure beans from someplace else. But I think the Chinese are probably at a point where they don't want to buy too much more at these price levels.
Corn on the week was lower, but I suspect you're happy that wheat managed to gain a couple of cents.
You know, wheat in Europe is really what lit this market or came to light at mid-session and brought the wheat market back around. And the Paris wheat hit a 3.5-month high on very dry spring weather. So you have the China plain with very cold temperatures next week, and you have the European Paris French wheat really starting to get a little bit fearful about a drought. I think that puts wheat still in the leadership when it comes to the corn. The biggest thing about the corn market is this March 31st low of 375 and a quarter. If we hold that, then we'll probably see a lot of short covering come in because there were a lot of eager potential buyers until this morning. And I suspect they're still on the table and still want to get into the market, but they want to see support hold. So 375 and a quarter on the downside is real important for Dease corn. Last week's high of 394 and a quarter, which is also the 50-day moving average, that's going to be a breakout point.
And you mean a low on the settlement price, right? So at this point, we have a 376 and a half low. We were down 16 cents on the week in the corn.
Exactly. Yeah, we had a 376 and a half low. The March 31st low is 375 and a quarter. I think that's the low that I think the market will be looking at. And if that holds, then I think you'll have some potential buying come back in. I like the way the outside markets turned around. I still think the outside markets, excluding the dollar, have still got a lot of play in these grains. The dollar was more involved with the euro currency and the Greek debt crisis, which that, again, has to stay on our radar screen because what I'm reading today, they're not out of the woods. They've just been given a Band-Aid, but they haven't been taken care of permanently by any stretch of the imagination.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Have a great weekend, Todd.
Hey, you too. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every Friday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You are listening, of course, to Illinois Public Media and the Closing Market Report. Dave Dickey is your Director of Ag Programming. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the program. Now here's Dave with the news.
In agricultural news, U.S. senators writing a massive climate change bill struggled yesterday over how to reduce carbon dioxide pollution in the transportation sector. Senator Lindsey Graham says, quote, "The transportation sector is a problem. We're just dealing with that." Graham has been collaborating with Democratic Senator John Kerry and Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman on a bill they hope to sketch out on Monday. Asked whether the trio will be able to meet that deadline, Graham says, quote, "I don't know yet." The Obama administration Thursday promised to contribute $475 million to a global food security trust, but whether the administration will be able to live up to that commitment is uncertain. Nearly $408 million of that total would need to be appropriated by Congress. The U.S. and China have announced new anti-dumping steps against each other over aluminum, nylon, and optic fiber, possibly reviving strains over trade and currency that had eased in recent weeks. The U.S. Commerce Department is launching an investigation into whether Chinese extruded aluminum products were being dumped or sold at improperly low prices due to government subsidies or other aid. China's Commerce Ministry criticized the measure. The Commerce Ministry says it is imposing anti-dumping duties of up to 96.5% on imports of nylon 6 from the U.S., Europe, Russia, and Taiwan. U.S. regulators have proposed to make broadband access the focus of subsidized telecommunications for the poor and rural areas, a first step in tackling an ambitious plan to provide high-speed internet to all Americans. The Federal Communications Commission unanimously proposed the shift in the goal of the Universal Service Fund despite a recent court ruling that called into question the agency's authority over the internet. India's government today says that India's summer monsoon is likely to be normal this year, allaying fears over an event crucial to the economic fate of the world's second most populous nation. Earlier, weather scientists from the U.S. and Britain said normal monsoon rains were likely in India, but a Japanese forecaster had said the seasonal rains would be weak this year. And China will release a total of 1.38 million tons of corn from the state reserves on April 27th, after selling nearly 80% of a similar batch earlier this week. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Well, the 1995 Freedom to Farm legislation adopted by Congress discarded many of the restrictions that had previously caused farmers not to change crops. Under it and farm bills since that time, producers have been able to participate in the farm programs and still make their own cropping choices. As you'll hear, a U of I study has looked at how acreage patterns have shifted in the United States since Freedom to Farm. The 1995 Freedom to Farm Act gave producers the option to plant what they believed to be their most competitive crops and still participate in the farm program. That choice tenet still underlies today's farm bill legislation, and when comparing the five-year period just before its enactment to the last 5 years, 2005, 6, 7, 8, and 9, there are clear-cut winners and losers in terms of crops and acreage, says University of Illinois farm management specialist Gary Schnittke.
What we saw is a movement towards soybeans and corn, and soybeans from gained 14 million acres from the early period to 2005 to 2009, corn gained 9 million. So those two crops were the only crops that gained in acres. The other crops, hay and rice, were stable, but the big losers were wheat, barley, and grain sorghum.
Again, when comparing the era from 1990 to 94 to 2005 to 2009, soybeans and corn grew in acres. Crops losing acres were wheat, barley, and grain sorghum, along with corn silage, cotton, peanuts, dry edible beans, and potatoes. to evaluate acreage changes. Data detailing acres harvested in the United States by year were obtained from the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Data were collected for all crops with over 1 million acres harvested in 2008. There were 13 of them: soybeans, corn for grain, hay, rice, wheat, barley, grain sorghum, corn for silage, cotton, peanuts, dry edible beans, potatoes, and sugar beets. Acres harvested were averaged for the years 1990 through 94, the years preceding the passage of the 1995 Farm Bill, and 2005 through 2009. Between the early 90s and the late 2000s, soybeans were the crop with the largest acreage increase. It averaged 58.2 million acres harvested in the early 1990s, increasing to 72.2 million acres in the late 2000s. It's a 14 million acre increase, or about 25%. Corn also had a sizable increase of 9.4 million acres, or about 14% from one period to the other. Wheat had the largest reduction, from 62.8 million acres to 50.7 million acres, or down 19%. The data, says Schnicki, shows the largest increases in corn and soybean acreages were concentrated in the Great Plains and the Greater Corn Belt.
The state that gained the most in corn and soybean acres was North Dakota, gained 4 million acres. And other big gainers were Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas.
Again, the commodities with the largest gains over the period pre- and post-Freedom to Farm were soybean and corn. Wheat, barley, grain sorghum, corn for silage, and cotton experienced the largest losses. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, joins us. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Of your 10 elevators that stretch across East Central and Central Illinois, who says the farmers are the farthest along?
I would say the northern area, Piper City, La Hogue, Danforth, Gilman is probably the furthest along. But overall, I'm guessing we have 80% of the corn plus in the ground right now.
That is a lot of corn in the ground. Are farmers happy they have it that way?
I think so. It went in relatively well. You know, they weren't mudding it in like the last 2 years, and we've got a sprinkle on it now with some more rain in the forecast. So it's hard to ask for a better scenario right now.
How's basis holding up?
Not too badly. The basis has been hanging in there. Corn has been steady to improving a little bit. Beans, not a bad basis, and typical choppy transition type late year short crop basis. So we're seeing that happen.
You expect movement next week as farmers take a little pause and the rainfall?
On the upticks, we saw some cash movement, and we saw some new crop sales too. Guys got their got the corn in the ground. We're happy with it. There was rain in the forecast, and when we had upticks, we were buying some new crop.
And what are your bids for the day?
We are at 336 on nearby corn and 983 on soybeans.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. In just a couple minutes, I'll return when we'll talk about the agricultural weather forecast.
It's St. George's Day, patron of farmers. George was born to a Christian family during the late 3rd century. Eventually, he was martyred after refusing to participate in the persecution of Christians across the Roman Empire. George was sainted in 496. On this day in agricultural history in 1856, Granville T. Woods was born. Among Woods' inventions was an electric incubator for hatching chickens. In 1981, artificial skin was first transplanted in the U.S. on patients at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. The combination of cowhide, shark cartilage, and plastic was developed by a research team at MIT. This material makes possible the treatment of burn patients whose injuries might otherwise be fatal. In 1985, Coca-Cola announced it was changing its 99-year-old secret formula. New Coke, though, was a big flop. In 1992, the first McDonald's in Beijing, China, opened. It is the world's largest McDonald's with 28,000 square feet, seating for 701,000 employees. And in 1993, Cesar Chavez died. He was the founder of the United Farm Workers Union. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. On a Friday afternoon, we're joined by Steve Hilberg. He's the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. It's located right here in Urbana-Champaign and belongs to NOAA. Good afternoon to you, Steve.
Good afternoon, Todd.
We have a rainy weekend forecast in store.
Yeah, we do, for a change. We've been pretty lucky the last couple of weeks with generally dry weather and not much rain so far in April, but that's going to be changing, and it looks like we'll make up a lot of the rain we haven't got here in the next few days, as we have a slow-moving cutoff system that will be lifting out through the Midwest over the weekend. So looks like most of Illinois and Indiana will probably pick up from 1 to 2 inches of rain by the time this is all the main part of the storm winds up later on Sunday.
And so we have a 3-day period. Farmers would like it to be a nice, slow, gentle rain. Will that happen?
Well, in some cases, yes, but there's likely to be some heavy rain, especially where we get heavier thunderstorms. Currently, radar showing most of the rain now north of I-74 from the Quad Cities down here towards Champaign, with the heaviest rain up in Ford and Iroquois counties right now. And they've already had up to an inch of rain in parts of western Illinois and southeastern Illinois since yesterday. So that part has been generally slow, but I think we're likely to see some heavier downpours, especially tomorrow afternoon and evening, as things thunderstorms fire up. We'll probably get we'll get another round of rain tonight and then a break probably during the middle of the day tomorrow, with things firing up again tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow night.
Yes.
So this is the time of year for thunderstorms, so we can't the likelihood of getting that nice, slow, gentle rain isn't very good.
Does that firing up come along with a cold front?
There will be a front moving through here later in the weekend with this upper low moving through, but that will keep temperatures down below normal to normal for the first half of next week, and then as the next system approaches late next week, we'll see the winds swing into the south and temperatures warm up again, but also bring another good chance for rain probably by next Thursday or so.
And can you get an idea of how big that one might be?
That could be, it looks like that could be another good thunderstorm type situation, where a strong cold front moving through and we'll get some heavy downpours along that. But it probably won't be a 3-day event. This will probably be in and out of here in 12 hours.
Yeah, so usually we hit our last frost day sometime in late April, early May. You don't see anything like that in the forecast, do you?
Not right now, although, you know, this week we got a little bit of a surprise. Even despite the warm weather during the days, we had the air has been so dry that it was not hard to get down to freezing in some areas earlier this week. Can't rule that out necessarily, especially this week with behind this low where it'll be some cool air, but I think right now it appears cloudiness and also some higher moisture content to the air will probably mitigate any chances for frost right now.
Steve, thanks so much for being with
us. All right, Todd.
Steve Hilberg is the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. We'll say so long now to some of our radio stations. For the rest of you, we'll continue on and we'll talk with Mr. Enan, who is the president of the National Corn Growers Association. And immediately after that, we'll hear a bit more about soybean production in the state of Illinois and whether April is a good time to plant soybean.
Programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Darren Enan. He is the president of the National Corn Growers Association, also known as the NCGA, and he's from Hurley, South Dakota. Mr. Enan and his family operate a farm growing irrigated and dryland corn and soybeans. They also raise stock cows and manage a contract hog feeding operation. He's been involved in the corn growers' issues at local, state, and national levels, participating in NCGA's Leadership Academy, the South Dakota Corn Growers Association, NCGA's Biotechnology Working Group and Production and Stewardship Action Team. Thank you very much for taking so much time with us today, Mr. Enan. We do appreciate you doing that.
You're very welcome.
What has been your issue of passion with the corn growers? Which one do you really get excited about?
Well, you know, I get excited about the ethanol industry. It's a great growth market for corn and for, you know, our corn products. I'm fortunate enough to be chairman of a board of an ethanol plant, so I've got a lot of experience and background and passion for that. But really, you know, it comes back to all of our end users, you know, livestock and exports. I mean, you have to be passionate about anybody that's going to use our corn. And however we can help them use more of the corn that we produce, that's really the goal. And so, you know, ethanol is, you know, kind of my first thing, but, you know, I've been involved in all facets of corn usage and corn growing. And so that's just kind of how I came to be part of the National Corn Growers Association, is just a passion for promoting our own product. And that's really the key, is how can we promote our product so that not only how we grow it and how we raise it, but also how we get people to use it, and how we get our end users to use all the corn that we grow.
I'd like to get just a bit of a sense about you in a broader perspective. What kinds of other organizations have you been involved in there in South Dakota, from the local school district, if you happen to serve on the board? I suspect you might be involved there, or other, whether you're involved with the Beef Association in South Dakota or the hog producers, or what kinds of organizations?
Well, you know, the first organization I really got involved with was corn, and so that is kind of where my passion was. It's where I spent a lot of my time. Locally, I was on a city development board that looked at trying to bring businesses and industries to a small town. I'm president of an ethanol plant board, so I've been the president on that since 2001, so that's been a long period of time where I've, you know, had the opportunity to interact with local leaders through our ethanol plant and other board members. Still a member of the South Dakota Corn Utilization Council, active with that yet. And then, I'm trying to think of what else I've been involved in. Just, you know, wherever, I guess if somebody asked me to help out someplace, that's what I've done locally. But, you know, a lot of my efforts have been, especially the last few years, have been nationally, but it's still nationally, all ties back to your state organization and working together with state corn grower organizations and the National Corn Grower Association for the betterment of all corn growers.
And who's the ethanol plant owned by? Is it a farmer-owned organization? And what's the name of that plant?
It is a farmer-owned plant, but it is a POET plant. So we work with the POET folks, but it is farmer-owned.
And the name of the plant is?
POET Chancellor.
POET Chancellor. And is it in Hurley, or is Chancellor the little town it's in?
Chancellor's a little town. Hurley's just in, my address is, I'm right between Hurley and Chancellor, so it's about 7 miles from the ethanol plant, so it's close. Our farm is actually located, for those of you from Illinois and Indiana, about 25 miles southwest of Sioux Falls, so I'm in the very southeastern part of the state.
Okay, well, thank you very much for all of that. Now, I want to ask you a quick question, because you are not only a corn grower, but you also raise livestock. You have stock cows. Do you still have them? And do you still have the hogs?
Yes.
And how do you? You probably get asked this a lot in the food versus fuel debate, and feed versus fuel debate. How do you reconcile those two debates with what you actually do on the farm? Because you're doing all those sorts of things.
Well, you know, it's it's a tricky explanation sometimes. I guess it comes back to, you know, as a corn grower, the livestock industry is important to us. The feed industry is important to us. The ethanol industry is important to us. And so, you know, what I try to stress is, you know, we can have our differences, whether, you know, it's, you know, with the other industries, whether it's food versus fuel or feed versus fuel issues, we can have our differences, but let's keep those differences amongst ourselves. Let's talk through them. You know, there's a lot of other areas we can work together. We do a lot of work with the livestock groups on environmental issues. We do a lot of work with them, helping them with the Humane Society of the United States type issues. And so we have a great working relationship with the livestock industry. We might disagree on the food versus fuel, but let's get past that. Let's concentrate and work on other areas that we know we can work. And the second thing is that we have provided the corn that everybody has needed. We've always grown enough corn to meet all of our end users' demands. And that's the key thing to remember, is that it's not food versus fuel or feed versus fuel. We've got corn for everybody. And again, we got a record carryout this year again. There's a lot of bushels around. And I guess that has put a lot of that myth and a lot of that tension aside, is because we are producing enough for everyone.
What's top of mind for NCGA as far as the ethanol issues and policies that should be debated at this point?
Well, you know, a couple areas right now. We're definitely lobbying for higher blends for E15. We think that's important as a corn grower, because we are growing more corn. We need to use more corn, but it's important for our country. Why not use homegrown fuel? Let's use products that we can make right in this country. It creates jobs. It's good for real economic development, and so that's a big issue. And the other issue that, you know, some legislation was just introduced here a week ago is extending the tax incentives for blenders, the ethanol companies and the blenders that blend ethanol. We want to extend those tax credits, and so there's a bill that's been introduced in the Congress to do that. And so that is that's an action center where we want our members to call their congressional folks to sign on and support that bill, because, again, renewable energies is a new industry, but why not use those dollars in this country instead of overseas buying foreign oil?
At what point do you think the industry will be able to function without the aid of the government?
Well, you know, the counterpoint that I would say to that is when can the oil industry function without aid from the government, because they still get tax incentives, they still get tax breaks. We spend a lot of money military-wise protecting those oil sources. And so, you know, by us using the tax credits, you know, that just helps us get on a level playing field with the oil industry. And, you know, the oil industry is our competitors, and so this blender's credit, for example, entices them to use our ethanol product, because we are competitors. And so, you know, we just want a level playing field. And, you know, the oil industry's been around for over 100 years now, and they've had some type of financial assistance from the very beginning. And so that's something that not all people realize.
What are the other issues that are top of mind for you? Are you working with conservation or biotechnology, insect risk, resistance management? What's next on the list?
Well, you know, of course, we're always working on insect-resistant management. We want to make sure that, and try to educate growers so that they are planting the refuge, making sure that we can keep these biotechnology events available to us on our farms, because if we don't comply and if growers don't follow the rules, we do have the risk of losing these products. I mean, we are using a regulated product by the EPA, and they watch that very closely. As far as environmentalists, we belong to a group called Field to Market that's put out some great information here in the last year or so on sustainability, and it's got some good background information on how we've improved how we farm and how we raise crops in the last 20 years. You know, we're using less water, we're using less pesticides, we're saving oil on our soil erosion, and so there's just a lot of nice benchmark things that environmentally that we are involved with. And this Field to Market involves, you know, McDonald's and Coca-Cola. It's not just ag groups. And so it's a nice broad spectrum of people that are from the food industry back all the way to the farm to show that we are doing more with less and doing a good job protecting our environment.
Mr. Enan, can you tell me more about the kinds of things that NCGA is involved in? And I'm thinking maybe I'd like to talk a bit about transportation issues. You're looking for reliable and cost-effective transportation for reaching marketplaces. Are we mostly concerned with rail transportation, river transportation, all of the above?
Well, it's definitely all of the above. Of course, you know, one thing that I failed to mention earlier that I really need to stress is that we are working very hard on getting the locks and dams upgraded on the Illinois, Ohio, Mississippi rivers. We think that's important to not only move our products downstream, but to get products that we use on our farms and that our urban friends use that come up the river. And so, you know, we're working very hard to get appropriations. Of course, the legislation has been passed to fix and rebuild some of these aging locks. Now we just have to find the money to do it. So river transportation is very important. We also are working on rail transportation, some of that kind of legislation that protects us as shippers. The railroads are kind of, it's a monopoly, and so we're just working on some legislation that protects us to make sure that we get a fair deal when we ship our products. So transportation is very important. And, you know, one thing that we probably should talk about is communications, just like this interview here right now, great opportunity for us to reach not only our farm friends in the countryside, but also to reach our urban friends so they understand agriculture, they understand how we do our businesses, and the National Corn Growers has done a great job, along with our states, working together, putting out great pieces of media. We're working on videos that are on YouTube. Just communication is the key, and just informing people on really how we run our operations and how we are doing a good job here on the farm.
Just a few minutes left. Let's talk about transportation, the locks and dams. Some money has been put aside for that, actually raised by a fee on fuel for the boats that run the barges up and down the rivers, and that's been in place for a very long time. But you've been not successful in actually making Congress, or getting Congress, I suppose, to fund the other half of that program, although there is legislation that was passed. They just haven't found the money. Why didn't it come out of the stimulus packages?
Well, the way the stimulus bill was written, it said it had to be shovel-ready. And, you know, this wasn't quite shovel-ready, unfortunately. I mean, even though we know it has to be done, it would be a tremendous opportunity to create jobs, create economic development along the river by maintaining and fixing and rebuilding these locks. But it didn't qualify under the stimulus, unfortunately. I mean, what better way to use tax dollars if you're going to be spending money than something that would actually create jobs? And so that was frustrating. But again, you know, like you mentioned, the industry, the fuel tax pays for some of the construction. And of course, that comes right out of me as a corn shipper. For example, if my corn gets to the river and goes down the river, I'll pay a little bit higher. I'll take less for my corn to help on the fuel tax to upgrade the locks and dams. I mean, corn growers are very committed to working through this issue of getting the river transportation fixed. And, you know, we just challenge not only the government but other users on the river to do the same thing, because it is a critical, important link in our transportation system. And if we don't keep it up to date and modern, you know, the rest of the world is definitely building, and they will pass us up.
Darren Enan is the president of the National Corn Growers Association. That's the NCGA. He joins us from Hurley, South Dakota. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media.
In business news, Democrats have set an initial showdown vote for next Monday on legislation to clamp new regulations on the financial industry. Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid says, quote, "The time for stalling is over." However, without an accord with the Republicans, which were blocking the start of formal debate on the bill, Democrats would need 60 votes to move ahead in the Senate. All 41 Republicans in the 100-member Senate remained publicly opposed on Thursday. Abbott Laboratories says its first quarter profit fell 30% despite strong sales due to a one-time gain it recorded last year. The North Chicago Drug and Medical Products Company says it earned $1 billion, or 64 cents per share, in the 3 months that ended March 31st. That's down from the $1.44 billion, or 92 cents per share, in the same period last year. Yara International ASA, the largest publicly traded nitrogen fertilizer maker, fell to a five-month low in Oslo as first-quarter sales missed analyst expectations. The company sees a clear risk that demand for nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium fertilizers, known as NPK, may fail to fully recover this season in Europe because of higher potash prices, a late spring, weaker grain prices, and a weaker euro. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World. I'm Todd Gleason. Vince Davis, University of Illinois Extension soybean specialist, is here now to talk about his favorite crop. Vince, let's start with this question. Is it too early to plant soybeans?
Yeah, we've had an outstanding April, quite a different April than we've experienced the last few years, and corn planting progress has been moving very fast, and that's allowed a lot of growers to either start planting soybeans or contemplate the decision of planting soybeans since we're in late April here. There are a couple things to consider when you're planting soybeans in April, and one is in seed bed preparation, and another is to look at the forecast and think about how warm your soil temperatures are and what those conditions or the chances of the conditions are going to be for those soybeans to sit in real cold, wet soils for a prolonged amount of time over the next couple of weeks. And of course, there is the consideration of whether there's a risk of frost or not once the seedlings are emerged. In much of the state of Illinois, there's not a lot of risk of frost once we get to the month of May. If you look over the weather data for the last 20 years, we occasionally have frost in the first week of May in the most northern tier of Illinois, but it's usually less than about 5% of the time. So the risk of frost in the month of May is pretty low. And if you're planting soybeans in April, the date that you need to be most concerned about is the date that the seedlings emerge, which is going to be 7 to 10 days after they're actually planted. And so we generally say if you're planting April 20th to April 23rd, those seedlings probably aren't going to be emerged till around the 1st of May, and the risk of a killing frost is pretty low. Now, the risk of prolonged periods of real cold, wet rain and in cold soil temperatures is still somewhat high, and that's definitely a consideration to think about as well.
Best date in the state of Illinois is, what, the 27th of April?
Well, in previous planting date studies that we've conducted, the best planting date can be anywhere from the 27th of April to May 9th, and it's difficult to determine how much response differences in soybean planting date between that last week of April and the first week of May. So anywhere in that two-week window is a really optimal two-week window to maximize yield, as long as the seedbed and the weather preparations or the seedbed preparation and the weather conditions are conducive for that. We don't see consistent yield losses to planting date start till somewhere after the first week of May, but certainly by about May 10th to May 15th, we're certainly losing yield to planting date in soybean.
We've moved along quickly this spring in terms of corn planting. Producers probably still have quite a bit of work to do. If you're a corn producer, this is tough for you as a soybean specialist, but if you're a corn producer, given a choice between side dressing anhydrous or putting nitrogen on and planting soybean after we get through this wet period, which would you do?
Well, certainly it's been pleasant to be able to be this far ahead in corn versus a lot of recent years. And there's still going to be some decisions as to what kind of maintenance you do in your corn versus getting started on soybeans. And when you're in the last week of April, first week of May, I would certainly say in a lot of cases, some of the corn activities would take some precedence over getting too overly ambitious on a soybean and soybean management. But there would certainly be nothing that should stop people from trying to get some of their soybeans in the ground and to really go after maximum yields for some of their acres as we approach real late April and early May on some acres. But the nice thing is when we talk about planting soybeans earlier to maximize yield, what we're usually talking about is trying to get soybeans planted in that first half of May versus when we're normally planting soybeans in this state, and that's real late May, in many cases June. And so the fact that we're much further ahead in April on corn, hopefully that'll allow growers to get a lot of their corn activities out of the way, and we can get to a lot of the soybean planting early in April this year.
Are you an advocate of lower plant populations? If so, what to what level, and what are the primary best management practices that need to be done?
Well, as we see the seed cost for soybean seeds over the last several years really escalate for the growers who are buying the most elite genetics, the response to seeding rate in soybeans is really wide, meaning there's not a lot of yield response for a very wide range of seeding rates, provided you get good stand establishment. The ultimate goal is that we want 100,000 uniformly spaced plants per acre once they're established. So growers should calculate basically back from that based on the type of planter they have, the planting system, their seedbed preparations, and the germination rate of the seed that they're using. So if a grower is doing a good job with seedbed preparations and expect they can get good seedling emergence and have good germination rates, they can probably maximize their economics at somewhere between 130 and 150,000 seeds per acre.
And when they do that, they need to think about one other thing: inoculants.
Well, soybean seed treatments and inoculants, but more so soybean seed treatments, as you reduce your seeding rates, can help protect that investment. As you lower that seeding rate, you want to have more assurance that you're going to get more of those seedlings or seeds to germinate and emerge up and out of the ground. And so we do see the value of some seed treatments. The value will increase as you want to reduce that seeding rate a little bit.
We're out of time. Vince Davis is an extension soybean specialist at the University of Illinois. You can always read more from him online. The address for the U of I bulletin is at www.ipm.illinois.edu/bulletin. This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.